to Seed, inspiring a shift in agriculture towards adaptation, community, and diversity. I am your host, Joseph Lofthouse. This is my first solo podcast after Shane Simonson started his own podcast, Zero Input Agriculture. We wish Shane joy and success in his new endeavor. In this episode, I'm posting the presentation that I did at the Utah Farm and Food Conference, January 11th, 2024, in Cedar City, Utah. Red Acre Center for Food and Agriculture hosts the conference. Red Acre Center advocated for the passage of Utah's Food Freedom Law, which allows individuals to sell food to each other without licenses or regulations. The center attends the legislative sessions each year, advocating for increased food freedom and continuing preservation of the gains already made. I highly recommend the work of Red Acre Center, and pause for a moment of reverence for Sarah, Cimbria, Mark, Sean, and all others involved in supporting this work. GoingToSeed.org sponsors this podcast. Join us there for seeds, farmer support, and complimentary content like video courses and online forums. Without further delay, here is my presentation. Welcome, everyone. My name is Joseph Lofthouse. I will be talking about adaptation agriculture today. Oh, and I'd like to thank Red Acre Center and Going to Seed for sponsoring my visit here today. I come from up in Cache Valley. So I used to be a wonderful, great farmer, and I would take all kinds of lovely things to the farmer's market. I was even taking crops to farmer's market that don't grow in my valley. Okra, for example. It's too cold up in Cache Valley to grow okra well. I was taking muskmelons to farmer's market. That is a really good place to be as a farmer. The only farmer that has a crop that is super beloved. I was growing squash, just abundance of squash. So did all my other neighbors, but you know, it was fun and just really productive in my garden. And I was running a CSA, growing about 100 varieties of vegetables for my customers. And I was doing all of this without fertilizers, without compost, without pesticides, with minimal labor, and just having a beautiful time being a farmer. I was participating in the HB 181, the Utah Freed Freedom Law, where I was making value-added products, selling them to my neighbors. Thank you to Sarah and Cimbria and Mark for all that they did to get that law passed. Then people kept saying, you should write a book telling us all about how you did all of this. And so I'm like, okay. So I wrote the book, Land-Based Gardening, Food Security Through Biodiversity and Promiscuous Pollination. It could have also been called How to Grow Food When You Can't Buy Seeds, Fertilizers, or Pesticides. My farming came crashing down because my book sold 9,000 copies. Just people wanted me to be going to conferences, translated my book into French. And so I started going to all these conferences, more than 100 conferences I spoke at. And this is Chef Dan Barber from New York. We're on the stage at Baldor Bites, which is the major food chef cooperative in the East Coast of the U.S. This is Chef Dan Barber on my farm up in Paradise, Utah, eating in my house. I fed a 5-star Michelin chef in my house. And this is Chefs Amber and Robin, who have collaborated with me for many years. Amber used to be an intern at my farm, and she now owns a restaurant up in Cache Valley. I spoke in the 13 U.S. states and spoke to thousands of people over the years. This is both in mega conferences and also in backyard get-togethers all over everywhere. I was invited to speak in Europe. I spoke in 5 countries in Europe: Croatia, France, England, Scotland, and Denmark. When I stayed in Scotland, they put me up in a medieval castle. This village happened to be the village where they filmed the TV series Outlander. When I stayed in England, they put me up in a palace. Just had a beautiful experience talking about my book. When I stayed in Croatia, they put me up in a mud hut. And that is the epitome, the cutting edge of permaculture technology. So it was just a beautiful experience. We had a parade. And we danced and we sang and we just had a beautiful time. These two people are the editors of my book in French. Lovely to spend time with them. The last day I was in Europe, they put me in a car, sort of against my will, and they took me to visit my ancestral home in Denmark. I got to kneel in the church where my grandfather's grandfather worshiped and ancestors before that. So, how does a farm boy from northern Utah end up traveling the world to talk about farming? My family, when I was growing up, were all about control and domination in our farming. We used pesticides if anything was wrong. We used herbicides. We tilled the ground so that it was bare soil, and then we had to add synthetic chemical fertilizers so that we could grow something. Seeds that I planted were covered in poisons. After we took that poison seeds in our bare hands, we went and had lunch. No concern at all for any of those chemicals, what harm they might be doing to us, to the ecosystem. So then, what did I do? I went and became a chemist. And I was working on projects to develop pesticides when I was in high school. That work continued when I went to the university. I graduated from university, went to work in the pharmaceutical industry. Then I went to work in the pesticide industry. One of the projects I worked on was I was getting samples from tropical climates like the neem oil. It was a project that I developed 30 years ago to turn neem oil into a pesticide. Because supposedly for the Japanese, if it's a naturally occurring substance and it's poisonous, then you can use it because it's okay. And so, I'll tell you a story that's not on my script. So in the lab, because we were getting all these samples from all over, we had cockroaches that were the size of mice. And it was so fun because every once in a while, you know those toothpicks that you find that have the little flags on them for making fancy sandwiches? You'd find a cockroach with that sticking out of its heart leg in the hallway somewhere. But anyway, that was so fun. So that was a terrible time for me because I was involved in an industry that I knew was based on lies. The research we did was lies. The way we presented it to people were lies. And then to make matters worse, I was transferred into a department dealing with chemical weapons. I just kept doing my job. And it was horrible and dark. You can tell my health suffered from it. And my body was so inflexible, I could barely move. My mind was so inflexible, I could barely think. And then they transferred me to the biological weapons department. I went back to my desk, I wrote out a resignation letter, and I left the building never to return. I ended up in a monastery in Provo, Utah. I spent 3 years there while I was recovering. While I was at the monastery, I says, okay, I'm going to apply my chemical knowledge, my understanding of science, to figure out what is wrong with me. Why am I like I am? Turns out, for me, the vegetable oils were killing me because of the high concentration of the omega-6 oils in like the corn oil, the soybean oil, the canola oil, the cottonseed oil. Basically, all the oils that I eating were causing inflammation in my body, and they were just making me sick. So where do those oils come from? They come from the chemical companies that I had just stopped working for. The chemical companies own, like on corn, 85% of the corn seed that is sold by a chemical company. Like 90% of the cotton seed that is sold by a chemical company. And then in order to grow that crop, you have to apply the chemicals that the chemical company are applying to your crop. So that whole system is designed that the chemical companies own the seed companies, and the chemical companies are determining what we can grow, what we can eat. After 3 years, I left the monastery. I returned to my home village, and I became a farmer. I said, that is the furthest thing away from these chemicals that I can possibly get. I made a vow while I was that I would never use those chemicals again. I wouldn't apply poisons to my garden. I wouldn't apply the fertilizers to my garden. And I wouldn't use the plastics to protect my crops. So this field is 5,000 feet elevation. Those mountains are 9,000 feet elevation. So all summer long, the cold air comes down out of those mountains into my field, makes it super difficult to grow any warm weather crops. I could not grow the hybrid crops because they totally are dependent on those chemicals. And they just failed for me when I tried to grow them without chemicals, and so I thought, whoa, I'll grow these heirlooms, these open pollinated varieties. They didn't work for me either. Because what's the definition of an heirloom? An heirloom is a crop from far away and long ago. An heirloom was developed for like Iowa, where there's a long growing season, it's damp. Or an heirloom was developed for Oregon, where it's always cloudy and low elevation. And so the heirlooms also failed for me. If I bought a variety from the seed catalog, there would be like a 75% chance of it just failing on my garden. And there's no way for me to predict ahead of time which ones would fail and which ones would do good. If I tried to grow tomatoes, it would be like a 97% failure rate. You know, they just weren't happy growing in my garden. This is an okra plant, the first time I planted okra. After an entire growing season, you know, it got this high and it succumbed to frost on the first little hint of frost and it was gone. That was pretty typical of anything that I would try to grow. I was looking around for something that would be interesting for my customers. Just something that wouldn't be the boring yellow sweet corn that I had tried, that I'd grown my whole life. And there was a farmer in Indiana, Alan Bishop, who had a sweet corn with colors in it. And I got that corn and I planted it on the same day that I planted my hybrid sweet corn. except I'd got smart and I told the guy at the seed store that I wanted my hybrid sweet corn without the chemicals on it. So the corn I got from Alan germinated 100%. It grew beautiful. And the corn that I got from my seed supplier without the poisons germinated at 5%. When I tasted this, it blew my mind because every color on there is a different flavor and they're beautiful flavors. I says to myself, I am going to convert every variety that I grow into this kind of growing. The name we were using back then for this type of growing is landrace. And a landrace is a variety that is genetically diverse, it's promiscuously pollinating, and it's locally adapted. Because it's locally adapted, it becomes part of the community. It becomes part of the microbe community, part of the insect community, part of the human community. Since that time, we've started calling this adaptation agriculture. Crops that are promiscuously pollinating and genetically diverse so that they can adapt themselves to the environment. What I have found over the years is that the ecosystem does 80% of the selection, and all I have to do is just stay out of the way. So the first crop that I decided to work on was cantaloupes. I gathered together about 30 varieties of cantaloupes that I got from the internet, from the grocery store, from the farmer's market, wherever I could find seeds from cantaloupes. And I planted them. And the first year, most of what I planted didn't germinate, or it germinated and got this big during the growing season. But a few plants at the end of the growing season produced a few green fruits. I saved the seeds, replanted them. The second year, some of the plants grew small, some of them grew abundantly. There were two plants that second year that produced more fruits than 100 other plants all combined together. So save seeds, replanted. The third year, I was harvesting bushels and bushels and bushels of cantaloupes. And that third year has pretty much, in my experience, become what I call the magical year. Because the first year, anything that isn't suitable for my garden, it just goes ahead and dies. The second year, the best of the best cross with each other. And so by the third year, they can really thrive. And that happens over and over and over again. Another thing that happened with the cantaloupes that I was totally unprepared for is that every year before I save seeds from something, I taste it. If I don't like the flavor, I throw the seeds away. And so my cantaloupes ended up being super tasty, super sweet, super aromatic. One day, it was raining when I harvested and I didn't want them to get wet. So I put them in the cab of my truck instead of in the back of my truck. And the aroma gassed me out because they were just so aromatic. That's beautiful for farmers market. I had to give these a different name because I would go to farmers market and people would say, I don't like cantaloupe. And I'm like, this isn't a cantaloupe. This is a muskmelon. Because what I was growing was not even close to the same product that the grocery stores were selling. So those of you that are farmers in the room or gardeners, you go and you sell this muskmelon for $4 at the farmer's market. It has got $60 worth of seeds in it. So it didn't take me very long to realize that as a farmer, I could make a lot more money selling seeds than I could by selling fruits and vegetables. And so I converted my whole strategy towards the seed growing. Of course, if I'm growing seeds, I have an abundance of vegetables. And so I was still going to farmers markets and still supporting a community or a CSA. But my primary focus was to grow the seeds. Oh, and I was saving thousands of dollars a year on my seed costs because I wasn't having to buy seeds commercially because I was growing my own. And I was getting crops that grew better for me than any crops that I could possibly buy from a seed catalog. So I remember the okra that we started out with. There was one plant in the okra patch at the end of the fall that didn't care about the fall frost. And it produced seeds. So I saved seeds from that, replanted. 3 years later, the okra was taller than the farmer. I was harvesting okra to take to farmer's market just because it was locally adapted. All of my growing is done without fertilizers, without plastics. I have a greenhouse. I use it to start tomatoes and peppers early in the spring. That's mostly because there's a bug that eats my tomatoes if they germinate in the field. But if I put 3-inch plants out, the tomato can outgrow the bug, and peppers are just ornery up in my cold climate. But yeah, that was all done without high tunnels, without row covers, anything like that. The seeds that I grow, I send to Experimental Farm Network, which is in New Jersey, and they distribute them for me, so I don't touch them. Yes, the question was, do I direct sow? And it's like, I direct sow everything except the tomatoes and the peppers, just because I have found that that's more reliable if they don't have the transplant shock. So that gave me time to go to festivals, to party, to have a good time. Also, I lost 70 pounds because I had stopped eating the seed oils and I had stopped eating the sugar and the wheat that had been causing me so much problems when I was working in the chemical industry and my whole life was centered around eating the products of the chemical industry. I feel a lot better than I have in like the decades before this. So I was a farmer, and I'm kind of a lazy farmer, and I don't like weeding. I was having a real hard time growing carrots for farmer's market. So I says, okay, duh, we're going to apply the principles of adaptation gardening to the carrots. Because what happens with carrots, you plant them, they take 3 weeks to germinate, it's so slow, and by the time they've germinated, the weeds are this tall, and the carrots can't compete, and so I was just losing my crops over and over again to the weeds. And so I planted a crop of carrots and did zero weeding on them. First year, I got some carrots that were, you know, about this big and the diameter of a pencil. I saved them, grew seeds from them, but whoops, I get ahead of myself. You know where this is going. Well, so carrots are a crop that flowers the second year. And so the first year, they had produced a root. It was a tiny root, but it was enough of a root that the second year it could go to seed. And so then the second time I grew the carrots, I got harvested carrots about the size of my thumb. And so replanted those, grew seeds. The third year, I weeded the carrots one time. And you see this little carrot down here? That is what my carrots used to grow like. And this is what I had selected for them to grow like. Then the third year, with one weeding, I was harvesting carrots that weighed 3 to 5 pounds each. And so now I can reliably grow carrots for the farmer's market. I've never sold those, except that that photo went into my book and I sold 9,000 copies of my book. If you ever want to write a book, make sure that you take lots of photos of your garden, because you might want to put them in your book. One of the mistakes I made when I was, like 10 years ago, my computer was running out of disk space. And so I compressed all my photos down to these little photos, and then I couldn't use them when I published my book. So if I had it to do over again, I'd just buy disk space to store the photos. So the question was, when we're saving carrots for seeds, do you harvest the roots and store them inside or in the ground? Yes. It's really hard for me to store carrots either way, but I do some of both, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And if I had it to do over again, I would select for carrots that could store in the ground, because that's easier for me as a farmer than trying to store them in sand in the garage or something like that. If I put straw over top of them in the fall, about, you know, a foot of straw, they'll store all winter. Pollination is highly localized. When you watch a bee pollinating flowers, it goes from here to here to here to here. It doesn't go from here and back to here. And so you can grow multiple crops on your farm if they're separated by whatever the distance is that works for the crop. Like when I grow squash and there are 100 feet separation, I see about 5% cross-pollination between them, which, you know, is okay. And I don't mind that. I love my yellow crookneck. It always has to be yellow. It always has to have a crooked neck. And so I grow my yellow crookneck in isolation. I might grow 20 different varieties of yellow crookneck all mixed together, but they're always yellow, they're always the crookneck shape. With other crops, I like the cross-pollination, because the cross-pollination allows the local adaptation to occur. And if we're inbreeding, the plants are getting weaker every generation. Because a crop that self-pollinates loses half of its remaining genetic diversity in every generation. And so this is how I was taught to farm when I was growing up: control, domination, perfect weeding. I decided I wasn't going to grow that way anymore. So this is how I currently grow my beans. I might run the tiller along the edge of the bean row, but inside the bean row, they're totally unweeded. Because of that, I now have beans in my garden that have gone feral. They plant themselves, they grow themselves, and all I have to do is go to harvest them. What a beautiful thing for a farmer to do, just walk out into a field and harvest something that grew itself. Which gives me more time to play and have fun and learn to play the guitar and learn to chant. So I thought that I would do this same kind of strategy with tomatoes. Ha! When the tomatoes were domesticated, 95% of the genetic diversity got left in the wild. That is genetic diversity for how to deal with the farmer's habits, with the soil, with the diseases, with the bugs. And so there just wasn't enough genetic diversity left in tomatoes for me to be able to do a breeding project with them. So I started looking around. How can we solve this problem? It turns out that there are tomatoes growing in the Andes Mountains that are promiscuously pollinating. Some plant explorers went and gathered those seeds together 50 years ago. This is a promiscuous tomato flower from the Andes compared to a domestic tomato flower. So I crossed those together and found tremendous diversity in the leaf shapes, in the fruits. But the most amazing thing that came out of this crossing was we were finding flavors that are totally unknown in tomatoes. Our taste testers are describing them as tangerine, guava, plum, melon, just these beautiful aromatic tropical flavors. We found one that a chef calls sea urchin. Anyway, but just these beautiful flavors. This is the current generation that was grown in Moss Beach, California this summer. Just delightful tomatoes. Chef Dan Barber took some of my tomatoes because he's enamored with the flavors of the tomatoes. And he submitted the tomatoes to Dr. James White, who's a microbiologist at Rutgers University. See the blue in this? That's the root hair of one of my tomatoes. And those are nitrogen-fixing bacteria that are living in the roots of my tomatoes.
Turned it into a
15 years of not adding fertilizer to my garden, the tomatoes and the microbes figured out how to support each other. Those same types of nitrogen-fixing bacteria live inside the roots of corn. People tell you corn, you have to fertilize it like everything because it decimates the garden and the soil fertility. No, corn knows how to have relationships with microbes. This gel that surrounds the roots of the corn is a host to microbes that make nitrogen for the corn. What the chemical companies did is they sprayed pesticides on the fields that damaged the microbe population. They sprayed chemical fertilizers on the fields, which damaged the microbe population. And they selected for corn that doesn't have these roots. So the corn, even if you didn't apply that kind of chemicals to the field, couldn't make its own fertilizer because it doesn't have the roots that interact with the microbes. And so one of the projects that I've been involved in is selecting for those kinds of roots on corn, which were the ancestral way that corn was grown. But that little root nodule, when you're tilling your fields, it doesn't break down very easy. And so it's annoying to farmers. So if you select against that, you know, you help the farmers. Anyway, just... So if you see corn that has that in your gardens, glom onto it and treat it special. I apply this same sort of principle everything that I grow. I like bugs in my garden. This is a Colorado potato beetle. It likes to eat potatoes. And in my garden, I made a contract with the Colorado potato beetles. I said, I will never spray you, I will never poison you, I will never harm you in any way as long as you don't eat my potatoes or my tomatoes. Because I have a wild weed that I grow in my garden. Let's see, what's it called? Solanum physalifolium is the old name, but it was the original food for the Colorado potato beetle before we imported potatoes and tomatoes. They can eat that all day long, and I won't ever bother them if they're eating that plant. If they eat one of my potatoes or my tomatoes, I'll kill the eggs, I'll kill the adults that I find on the potatoes. And so what that has done, basically, is a breeding project for the beetles. You know, teaching them what is their preferred food source and what is totally safe for them to eat. But if I have a potato or a tomato, an eggplant that attracts the bugs more than once, then I'll kill my tomato so that I don't, you know, mix up the contract. That kind of relationship wouldn't work with like the cabbage white moths because they blow in on the wind. But the Colorado potato beetles, they live on my farm year-round. So we just developed a nice, you know, working relationship with each other. Ha. I'll tell you a story about Julie Sheen. We'll have something from her later on too. But she asked if she could plant squash in my garden. And I'm like, sure, go ahead. So she bought seeds from the seed catalog and planted them in my garden. And to me, I'd never had any problems with squash or with squash bugs or disease of squash in my garden at all. They just grow abundantly. I don't have to worry about them. I just add irrigation water. When she planted them, the squash bugs just pounced on her stuff, and the diseases pounced on her stuff. I know it's naughty of me, but I was so happy. Because it showed that by allowing my plants to figure out how to deal with these things, that my plants were strong and those diseases and bugs existed in my garden, but my plants didn't care. So just a, you know, a great object lesson for me. So raccoons used to come into my corn patch and they would eat my corn. And so I'm like, I'm going to apply these same kind of principles to my corn. So the first year I planted corn in the most skunk and raccoon infested field that I had. The animals came in and ate 90% of my corn crop. Wonderful result. So second year I replanted in that same field. The corn, the skunks and the raccoons only ate 50% of my corn crop, making progress. So the third year, they didn't touch my corn because the corn had learned how to be strong, healthy, how to outcompete the skunks and the raccoons because they're kind of lazy animals. They don't want to climb up a corn stalk to eat a cob. They like to just come and push the plant over, eat it off of the ground. And so my corn, instead of the cobs being this high off the ground, they had went up to like higher, the stalks were stronger. So they had figured out for themselves how to live in my garden with the animals. Yeah.
What is your irrigation method?
So I sprinkle irrigate once a week or twice a week. The university would like me to irrigate twice a week, but that's kind of annoying. So once a week works better for me.
For a long time?
Our irrigation system is set up for 1 inch of water a week. So that's 12 hours a week of whether I run it 6 hours twice a week or 12 hours once a week. I welcome bugs, pests, viruses, and molds into my garden. They are teaching my plants how to survive. They're selecting for plants that thrive in the ecosystem exactly as it exists. That is my whole adaptation agriculture summed up into one word. So I do not practice crop rotation. I want as many diseases in my garden as I can possibly have, so that the plants can figure out how to survive. Because these plants have been surviving millions of years before people came along. They know how to do this stuff. We don't have to interfere. We don't have to control everything. Ha! So I went to Europe and they started heckling me. Oh, this is wonderful for you in the US, but how do you deal with slugs? And I'm like, I don't have slugs. How do I know how to deal with slugs? So I started interviewing every farmer I could interview in Europe about how to deal with slugs. The bottom line was, the more life you have in your garden, the less problem you have with slugs. No-till gardeners, no problem at all with slugs. Where the slugs were a problem for people was where they were tilling and they were making a moonscape and then they were putting their plants in the garden And so the only thing the slugs had to eat was the plants that had just been put in the garden. But the farmers that took their prunings from their orchard and they put them in little rows in the garden so that there would be microbes and fungus and beetles living in the garden and having an ecosystem to live in. The farmers that had 100 species in their garden instead of 5 species in their garden had little problem with slugs. The more life, the healthier a garden. So I am starting to get old, and I'm not liking to work even less now than I used to. So I land race everything, my chickens. I'm working on land racing trees, because a tree is something that can outcompete the weeds and it can just grow and take care of itself. And I go in as a farmer and harvest it once a year. While I was in Europe, I paid a lot of attention to the food that was in Europe. There was some nice food. There was also a bunch of ho-hum food. And what I decided at the end was the food that is grown by Amber, my local baker, is every bit as good as anything I had in Europe. Amber sources her food, her wheat locally. It's grown, milled by a local miller. It is inoculated with a local sourdough starter. It's prepared by her local staff. Nowhere in Europe did I have bread that tasted better than that local bread that she was producing for me. So one of the beautiful things about saving my own seeds is that I get to taste every fruit in every generation before I save seeds from it. So that the stuff I grow just becomes beautiful tasting to me, to my customers. If I take a Hubbard squash, I cross it with a banana, I get a hybrid. And that hybrid is not a monster. It doesn't develop poisons. It doesn't develop spines. It doesn't, you know, creep out in any way. It's just a beautiful squash. This particular hybrid combines the savoriness of this with the sweetness of this. Just a beautiful variety. One of the joys of tasting squash is that it is best done as community. So we get together and we have squash tasting parties. We have popcorn tasting parties. Anyway, beautiful times together. So remember this dire thing that I started with about how the chemical companies own the seeds. And turns out that 80 to 90% of the seed that is grown in the world is grown by farmer seed networks. It's not grown by these big companies. It's grown by farmers that share with each other. It's grown by backyard gardeners. It's grown by small regional seed companies. So we can pretty much just forget about this system and ignore it and focus on our local efforts. Our local efforts are already doing, you know, amazing work, and we're already plugged into that. So let's continue to do what we're doing and not feel like we have to be inadequate because we don't have a university degree. Every variety that I grow was developed by indigenous farmers who were illiterate, who had no understanding of DNA. They were farmers that went out into their field, they found something that they loved, they saved it, they replanted. Every one of us can do that same kind of work. While I was in Europe, this was the best meal that I ate. And why? This butter was produced by a farmer a mile from where I ate it. He added salt to the butter with his own hands. And there were still little pieces of, maybe you can see it here, little pieces of the the whey that were still in the butter. And it was just delightful. That sausage was made by a farmer that had raised the pig himself, that was within 5 miles of where I ate that sausage. He put that sausage in that little tube all by himself. Just the local food that I eat is always the best food that I've ever eaten. If we can move ourselves towards having some local food more often, it'll be easier to plug into the local food networks. So let's talk about some people that are doing local food right. Redmond Heritage Farms, they have kitchens in Sugar House and Orem, and they are cooking their French fries in coconut oil. That's a safe oil that's not damaging people's health by the high concentration of omega-6 oils. Shout out to Redmond for doing that. Grand Prismatic Seed in Salt Lake City, Utah is a local. All right. She's giving me the 10-minute warning, like, late. But they're producing local seeds in Salt Lake City, Utah. Non-GMO, no pesticides, no synthetic fertilizers, just beautiful seeds. Snake River Seed Co-op up in Boise, Idaho. They're a little bit outside of our ecoregion, but we're pretty close. We're high altitude, we're dry, and so Snake River Seed Cooperative, one thing they have going on is they will tell you where every lot of seed was grown, who the farmer was, where the farmer's location is, so you can really get local seed. A lot of the heirloom seed catalogs that you get, like, I won't name names because that would be rude, but they buy their seed in the Netherlands, they buy it in Vietnam, they buy it in Oregon, places that are totally different than our local ecosystem. And so when the seeds get here and they don't know how to grow, we blame ourselves for being bad farmers when we should be, you know, looking at our seed source and saying, why did that seed fail? Because it's not locally adapted. Giving Ground Seeds. This is the company owned by Julie Sheen that I told you about with the squash bugs up in Pocatello. When she left my farm, she took many of my varieties with her. They're available in her seed catalog. Here's another thing that I really like by the Buffalo Seed Company. They say, this is where our crops are likely to do super well because that's the best match to our ecosystem. And then they say, well, they might do okay in this other region. I also sent Buffalo Seed Company a complete archive of my garden, and many of my varieties are for sale from the Buffalo Seed Company, but grown in Kansas, and so they're going to be more locally adapted to Kansas now than they are to my garden up in Cache Valley, but still a beautiful resource for genetically diverse crops. The Open Source Seed Initiative is an organization that's devoted to keeping seeds. Did you just do me 5 minutes? Okay. To keeping seeds free. I am an admin for the Open Source Plant Breeding Forum, which they host, where we talk about plant breeding. The organization that sent me here today is Going to Seed, whose mission goal is shifting agriculture towards adaptation, community, and diversity. We have courses. Julia Dakin here called me up after I published my book and says, I want to make a video course about your book. And so there's a video course about my book that's freely available. Dr. James White made a course for us about microbes. We hired some farmers down in Mexico to make a video about traditional farming methods. All of those are available for free on the Going to Seed website. This is some of the staff at Going to Seed. This is Anna Miritz down in Moss Beach, California. She put together this slide deck for me and made many of the graphics, and she helps me to figure out how to be a better storyteller and stuff like that. And so thank you, Anna. There was supposed to be a video here which we're going to skip, but I'll tell it to you anyway. So I don't have any patience for blossom end rot in my garden. I see something with blossom end rot, I yank it out and toss it. Because I'm not a bad farmer, because I don't know how to water, because I don't put calcium on my tomatoes. That's a genetic defect in the tomato. So it shouldn't be growing in my garden because I don't appreciate it. Let's not blame ourselves. So we have an online discussion forum where we talk about these principles. We do online get-togethers and Zoom calls and just chat or have guest speakers. I do a podcast. We attend conferences all over. This was in California at the Heirloom Seed Expo. We do a seed share where we gather together genetically diverse crops from all over, dump them all into a jar, redistribute them. That makes it really inexpensive to collect genetic diversity. For some of the projects I've worked on, I've had to buy like 30 or 100 packets of different varieties of seeds and combine them in my garden. And that's really expensive. But if we cooperate as a community, that can be really easy. We're going to open the seed share for this year up to the public on, I think, February 5th. So if you want to jump on the Going to Seed website and join our mailing list, we'll send you a notice when that becomes available, or just watch the website. This was my contribution. There are, okay, 1 minute. All right, so the end. Thank you, everyone.